Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy, online editor of America. Thanks for joining us. This week we're broadcasting from the offices of America House on West 56th Street in New York City, and we're talking about the July 30th through August 6th edition of America. And this week's cover story is called The New Lay Face of Missionaries by Vincent Grognani. Mr. Grognani writes that as the number of priests and religious and ministry around the globe declines, lay people are helping to fill the gap. To learn more about the subject, you can read an interview with Mr. Grognani on our website by clicking on the America Connects link on our homepage. Again, America Connects is all of our web-only content, and also there this week you can read an archive article, which we will also feature every week. This week it is by Father William O'Malley, a Jesuit priest and teacher of religion and English at Fordham Prep School in the Bronx. Father O'Malley has written literally dozens of articles for America over the years, and this week's issue is an article called Accessible Holiness. And online we have the archive article called Fathering an Adolescent Boy. You can access that by either clicking on the America Connects link or checking out the In These Pages link on the right-hand column of our homepage. And on this week's podcast, we were featuring an interview, as we do every week. We are interviewing this week Grant Galicho, associate editor of Commonweal Magazine and a former colleague of mine. Grant is the moderator of the .commonweal blog, and we'll be talking about that. Also this week, we have a reading of The Of Many Things by Patricia Kosman, our literary editor. And we hope you'll subscribe to our podcast. You can do that easily by going to our podcast link on our homepage or going to iTunes and searching under America Magazine. And finally, we'd like to thank Bill McGarvey, singer-songwriter, who provided the music for this week's show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast. I'm here this week with Grant Galicho, associate editor of Commonweal Magazine. Welcome, Grant.
Hi, Tim. Good to be here.
Yes, thanks for coming. Appreciate it. We're going to talk about a few things this afternoon, including we'll start off with the .commonweal blog, which you moderate, right?
That's right.
Right. And now, how long has the .commonweal blog been around?
We started, I think, in March 2006, so a little over a year.
Okay. And now, basically, why don't you tell our listeners who are not familiar with it how it works?
We have a roster of writers from theologians to lawyers, legal scholars, and then hack journalists like myself. And it's a very flexible format. They write whenever they write, whenever they want. They write about whatever they want. And we have comments enabled so that when our readers drop by and want to share their 2 cents or more, often do, they're free to do so.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. How does that work with the comments? So it's just, it's open, so people can comment whenever they like and they're not vetted in any way.
Right. Well, I mean, we do have some editorial power. I mean,
Of course.
So if someone curses or says something really terrible, we can go in and change it, as we sometimes do. But basically, users can for free sign up for an account, give their email, etc., and then they're free to post.
And how is it working so far? It seems like you've gotten some good conversations going in the comments boxes.
Yeah, no, it's been, it's a mixed bag since anyone can write whatever they want. But we've had some very, very informative threads about theology. We've had contributors who have written for us. You know, there'll be a blogger who writes something about an article that appeared in the magazine, and then the person who wrote the article will come into the comment thread and contribute. So that's I think been very, very exciting.
Yeah, and I think that's a tribute to the blog that there are actually people out there reading this and
Right. They're
interested in what folks have to say. One example of what you're talking about, Father Robert Mbelli, who's a frequent contributor to the blog, recently had a critique of a Jack Miles's review of Pope Benedict's book and posted that, and within a couple hours Jack Miles was taking part in the conversation, responding. And
yeah, that was I was not expecting that, but I think it was great. And I think our readers really appreciate knowing that every so often they'll actually get to interact with the people who are writing the articles that they're reading in the magazine.
Yeah. And I mean, generally, I mean, there's been a lot of negative press about blogs, about, you know, they can get out of control and they're sort of solipsistic. But there's a lot of interesting conversations that they can help sort of nurture.
Yeah. I mean, it's like any bar room. I mean, you know, you've got people who are excellent at holding a conversation, and then you've got people who maybe aren't. But my opinion so far is that the good outweighs the bad, and so we're going to keep with the comments for the time being.
Yeah, no, I think it's good. Now, Peggy Steinfeld's, Margaret O'Brien Steinfeld, who's a contributor, raised an interesting question the other day in the comments boxes. She said that it seemed like the blog to her was focusing a lot on Catholic issues and maybe not as much on politics or cultural issues. Do you think that's the case, or do you think there's a more variety of topics?
No, I think Peggy's right. I mean, and I think any survey of the posts over the last year or so will bear that out. I'm not exactly sure why. I think Dave Gibson explained it a little bit today. You know, I think he was just saying that there are a lot of Catholic things happening right now, and so that maybe readers are seeing that all of these Catholic topics treated or religious topics. But I mean, I myself as a reader and as the moderator would like to see more non-Catholic, non-religious stuff plugged on the blog.
Right, you do a fair amount of politics, for example.
That's right,
and people. And yeah, and you try to, you know, give a quick, you know, try to break news if there's something out there that people might not know about, get it up there right away. I mean, it's also a larger question we deal with here at America is, you know, what is the mission of a journal of opinion, a Catholic journal of opinion? Should you just be writing about church issues, or do you branch out and cover other issues as well? For good or for bad, a lot of people are looking to us these days just for the Catholic coverage.
Sure. And when you've got the Pope allowing the Latin Mass and releasing another document about non-Catholic religions, you know, these things are going to be commented on.
Right, right. So and you have had a bunch of comments on them.
That's right. Liturgy is nothing like, you know, nothing like liturgy to bring the comments in.
Right.
It's just delightful.
And one thing you did write about recently was the sexual abuse settlement in Los Angeles, which came down earlier this month in July. Now, this was $660 million.
That's right.
And 508 plaintiffs, correct? And so why such a big settlement in California?
Well, in 2003, the state passed a law opening a one-year window during which plaintiffs could file claims, and it didn't matter how long ago they had claimed that they had been abused. So they opened this window for 1 year, and there were, I think, something like 1,000 claimants and 1,000 plaintiffs. I believe the oldest incident covered by the settlement was something like 75 years. So this was abuse that had happened almost 75 years ago.
And this is an issue that a number of other states are facing, is that some people are pushing to repeal the statute of limitations. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people in church authority are spending a lot of time trying to lobby against this because it would be incredibly costly, as we're discovering in Los Angeles. I mean, this is a huge settlement compared to Boston, which was the epicenter of the sexual abuse scandal, which was, you said earlier, like $130 million or something like that. Now, fewer plaintiffs in that case, but it's just a huge number in L.A. Now, how is this going to affect the diocese and the archdiocese and their ability to provide social services?
Well, given that in 2006 they spent about $35 million on their various programs, whether they be social services, so we're talking about soup kitchens, ministry to AIDS patients, given, and also schools, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, the fact is that the way the settlement breaks down is that the archdiocese will pay about $250 million in cash. The insurance companies will cover $227 million, and then religious orders will take care of the rest. So that's $250 million in cash is a huge amount of money. And in 2006, the archdiocese was operating at about $79 million in the black. So given that most of their equity is in investments, which funds their various programs, I don't see how they'll be able to get by with the same level of services that they gave last year.
Now, Cardinal Mahoney announced in May that he's going to be selling the chancery to help pay for some of this, correct?
That's right. That was it was sort of a surprise, I think. I mean, in many ways, you know, it's he doesn't want any parishes to be affected, so he wanted to start by selling the building in his backyard, as it were, which I think is, you know, it sends a good message, but it's a very powerful one too, as well. I mean, that's the chancery, that's the main administrative building,
right?
And they're going to put it on the block and rent office space like any other.
And this is what happened in Boston, too. They had to sell their property.
Mansion,
mansion, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and also part of the settlement is that there is a there's going to be a review of some of the documents that the plaintiffs have been seeking. So.
Right. And this was a bit of a shock for people who had been following the case. I mean, especially for victims, because the Archdiocese had been fighting for years to keep these documents, that, which are the priest personnel files, out of the hands of plaintiffs and prosecutors. So basically what's going to happen is that a private judge will look at these files, and he will decide what will be made public and what won't. He will also entertain the objections of priests who are in the files. So, you know, that was a very large step, and it will be very interesting to see what's contained in those files.
Right. Now, Cardinal Mahoney has and his office has fought against this for a long time to release this.
Yes. They've argued both that the release of the files would violate the First Amendment and also that it would violate the priest's privacy. In the state of California, they have fairly strict privacy laws.
So that's where things stand now. I mean, looking around the country, are there other dioceses that are facing similar situations, or was this the big one?
This was the big one. You know, there have been other dioceses that have had different financial fallout, like Spokane. They went into Chapter 11 or whatever chapter the bankruptcy law covers the churches. So, you know, but every diocese is very different. So in Spokane, parishes are going to have to cough up some of the settlement money. And in San Diego, a bankruptcy judge recently told the diocese that if they didn't settle the cases by mid-August, the cases were going to go to trial. Not too long ago, the state of Ohio turned down this proposal to just open another window. And the victims groups have been working quite hard to get those windows open.
Get them repealed, right. Yeah. We're going to switch gears here a little before we end our conversation and talk about a little pop culture, which is another subject that's often covered on the .com and Wheel blog. Kathy Cavaney, who is a regular contributor, was blogging about The Sopranos for a long time.
That's right.
Now we're going to switch and talk about another HBO show here, John from Cincinnati, which you're a big fan of.
I am, unwillingly. I mean, I don't know why I can't stop watching, but I can't. Some of the performances are fairly wooden. Some of them are really good. The writing is good. There's a lot of swearing, but overall it's quite good. It's sort of like Twin Peaks for, I don't know how many of your listeners were familiar with that David Lynch show, which was quite a cult hit in the 90s.
Right. Now this show, John from Cincinnati, just to explain to our readers, is about a family of surfers in California.
Mm-hmm.
And this figure appears on the scene sort of from nowhere, John from Cincinnati, as he's called, and it's unclear who he is or where he's from.
Right. No, it's he seems to have some supernatural abilities, including healing, and some sort of ability to project himself on the astral plane.
Yeah, it's very strange, but as you said, very compelling. And I've only made it through three episodes, but we were talking earlier, and you said that as the season goes on, it seems to get even more theological.
Oh, yeah, yeah. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, which is the most recent episode that I've seen, there was an extended monologue delivered by John, who comes off as a kind of simpleton. He only can repeat what other people have said to him.
Mm-hmm.
But he can also, as the show has gone on, read minds. So he's starting to parrot back people's thoughts. And then at the end of the show a couple of weeks ago, there was an extended monologue where he delivered all of these lines through various tropes. So he would say something like, "My father, in my father, such and such." And he had never mentioned his father before, and it seemed explicitly theological. I mean, especially given the healing and moments in the show when he's touched people's foreheads and saying he's a sea god.
Yeah. This is a show created by David Milch, who did NYPD Blue, am I correct?
That's right.
And also Deadwood, which mm-hmm. Another show that was on HBO. And has he talked about these issues at all?
He has. He hasn't gone into much detail. In fact, he's said explicitly that he doesn't really know what the show is about, which makes me feel much better about my own confusion. But yeah, he said, I think he told Jay Leno or one of the late night guys that the show is basically, if God today wanted to speak to us, wanted to make his message known, why wouldn't he go through a family of surfers and drug-addled, you know?
Yeah, a pretty messed up family.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one is a drug addict, and yeah, no, it's... But it is compelling TV.
It is. It's it's utterly confusing. You know, that my wife and I will just sit there and be totally mesmerized. I mean, in part, it's the performances. There are a lot of very weird characters, and they say very strange. I mean, there's one guy who's a retired cop who believes that his bird can speak to him.
Right, played by the fellow from Married with Children.
Right, Ed O'Neill.
Ed O'Neill, right.
Yeah, whose performance is great. He's sort of a bear with a little bit of a temper, who misses his late wife, and doesn't, he's sort of like almost a stand-in for viewers. You know, he's very reluctantly a part of this.
Right.
You know, he doesn't really, he can't help himself, but get drawn into the world that John, whatever he is, has started to create for these people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's on Sunday nights on HBO. If you want to check it out, I think it'll be running through most of the summer. Anyway, Grant Galicho, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And hopefully you can come by again.
Will do.
Okay, great.
This is Patricia Kossman reading the Of Many Things column from America's July 30th issue. A literary war erupted some months ago. Dubbed the Battle of the Book Reviews, it pits book critics of print against electronic media, bloggers, in a virtual slugfest. The issue is as much the quality of book reviews as space and quantity. That I have to report on it is a sad commentary about print media coverage of works not only by well-known writers, but by lesser-known upcoming writers, about whom readers would know little were it not for the occasional nod by a columnist who pays attention to what the small presses are up to. Newspaper priorities have shifted markedly. The book section, simply put, does not generate revenue. So some papers have begun scaling back on coverage, shrinking, and in some cases, eliminating it altogether. In apportioning space for book reviews, as opposed, say, to sensational features, there will always be disparity. But at what cost? At a time when we should be promoting cultural literacy, this trend of shunning books and readers is all the more disturbing. Since reviewers' pay scales in the general press often vary, that influences print coverage to some extent. Ditto for independent literary journals. As for America, our book section, which covers both general interest and religious categories, introduces our readers to about 200 book titles each year. When the Atlanta Journal-Constitution recently eliminated its book review editor, shouts of protest arose from the National Book Critics Circle. Recent cutbacks have occurred at other national newspapers as well, including the Los Angeles Times, the Raleigh News and Observer, and the Chicago Tribune. This shrinking coverage gives opportunity to bloggers and online reviewers to pick up the slack, and they do. Michael Derda, a Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic for the Washington Post, commented in April on NBCC's website, and I quote, "If you were an author, would you want your book reviewed in the Washington Post and the New York Review of Books, or on a website written by someone who uses the moniker Novel Gobbler or Biaga Friend?" Close quote. While that remark is a bit over the top, literary critics would agree with Derda's overall assessment of the book review section as, quote, "the forum where new titles are taken seriously as works of art and argument." The National Book Critics Circle's campaign to restore and even expand print coverage is being waged with vigor. NBCC's site, Critical Mass, posts comments from concerned readers daily. Last year, more than 125,000 new books were born, and this year it is higher. But only a small fraction of them receive attention. Newspapers that have not eliminated reviews altogether have merged them into other sections of the paper, such as the opinion page, or moved them to another day. The Chicago Tribune, for example, is publishing its book reviews in the Saturday edition now, so they reach even fewer readers. The publishing industry's major venues for book coverage include Publishers Weekly, Kirkus Reviews, Book List, and Library Journal, the first two of which collectively review close to 10,000 adult and children's books a year. Unfortunately, these trade magazines are unavailable to most general readers and consumers. In working through a shifting landscape of diverse and evolving outlets, conversation is vital. If the shared goal is one of service to readers, as it should be, provided by qualified reviewers, the reviewers and literary critics must remain committed. Serious readers will not usually be wooed by a handful of gossipy, self-serving book, quote, commentators. No one denies the internet is here to stay, and members of the NBCC applaud the electronic opportunities for intelligent dialogue. The editor of Library Journal noted in Critical Mass this spring that, quote, the venues for discussion may be changing, but the need for them all remains. Whatever the outcome at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and elsewhere, quote, she concludes, quote, the NBCC campaign to save book sections in newspapers is a win-win for us all, end quote. Still, we as a nation, and especially we print journalists and editors, have a moral obligation to foster literacy and promote intelligent reading. Maybe the battle of the books should be a unified rally of this nation's readers, writers, publishers, and literati, a people's campaign, so to speak. Patricia A. Kosman.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. Tune in next week when we'll be discussing the August 13th through 20th issue. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.